The City Club of Boise is a nonpartisan forum dedicated to free speech and the open exchange of ideas on issues critical to the Intermountain Northwest. Its motto is, "Things happen when people start talking." You can find information regarding forums, salons, and tours at cityclubofboise.org. The premier sponsor for the City Club is Northwest Nazarene University and the NNU School of Business. Programs are also made possible in part by a grant from the Idaho Humanities Council, the state-based affiliate of the National Endowment for the Humanities. Forum series sponsors are AARP Idaho, Echelon Group, Micron, and St. Luke's Health System. The moderator for today's forum is Bill Manny.
Welcome to the City Club of Boise. I'm your moderator, Bill Manny. I'm a former City Club president. I'd like to welcome our radio audience listening to us on Boise State Public Radio. Media sponsors for today's forum include Boise State Public Radio, 670 KBOI, the Idaho Statesman, Idaho Public Television, and Pepper Shock Media. Our forum series sponsors are Micron, AARP, Idaho, Echelon Group, and St. Luke's Health System. Now, this is the second in our annual Marilyn Schuler Human Rights Forum, honoring our friend and fellow City Club board member, Marilyn Schuler, who died in 2017. Human rights were Marilyn Schuler's professional and personal passion, and we honor her each year with an event that focuses on this legacy for City Club and for the state of Idaho. The other thing that Marilyn felt very deeply about was young people, and she was the force behind creating City Club's student programs. And in fact, we have 42 students with us today, which is part of Marilyn's legacy. So thank you for being here, and please welcome the students with us today. Having students as part of our program is really important to City Club, and I know it's really important for Senator Buckner Webb. So if you're a student and you want to ask a question, make sure to write student on the top of your question, and we will try to get to as many of your questions as possible. In that same spirit, we want to honor one remarkable young man who is with us today, and who is following in Marilyn's example, her fearless leadership on human rights. Garrett Richardson is from Borah High School. He's served on Boise's Planning and Zoning Commission, the Mayor's Council on Children and Youth, the Boise City Ada County Housing Authority. He's worked with Two Birds, the student-led ad agency that works with businesses and nonprofits. At Borah High School, he's been involved with the Gender and Sexuality Alliance, the National Honor Society, and he's president of the Spanish Honor Society. He's been active in political campaigns, and he led a student walkout to protest after the Parkland, Florida shootings. So please welcome to the City Club podium, Garrett Richardson.
I'd like to start by giving thanks to the City Club of Boise and to everyone who's made this event possible. Civic engagement, student activism have been things that have been very important to my life and have been for a very long time, and I'm very grateful and honored to be receiving this recognition today. One of the central themes of French philosopher Jean-Paul Sartre's philosophy is the idea that we're born into a world that is inherently without any sort of structure, and that ultimately it's up to us to give the world that structure. And while thankfully things are changing, many of us today feel disheartened by the structures that are in place currently and feel like we are powerless to change them. Complicity with the status quo is incredibly easy, but unfortunately it often makes us overlook the issues that are happening in our communities, in our country, and in the world moreover. But now is not the time for complicity. Now more than ever, we need to be actively seeking out change to change the structures that are leading to hatred, violence, and discrimination in our country and our societies. We've been taught from a young age that it's not okay to discuss political or controversial issues. And we as young people, and as students especially, are frequently belittled in political spheres, told that we don't know what we're talking about. But we need to start changing both of these mindsets, because they're incredibly harmful to political discourse in the entire country. Ultimately, what we need to do is we need to recognize that student voices are just as valid and impactful as everyone else's. And by discouraging student voices now, we discourage students from participating in the future. And we need to put the end to this idea that we can't civilly discuss controversial and complex topics like gun control, marijuana legalization, or even a new library downtown. Well, yes, these are very complex and issues, and conversations can be very challenging, but they're absolutely necessary in order to foster understanding and ultimately change in the world. Last year, my friend Grace and I led a walkout at Bora after the Parkland shooting, and we gathered outside the school and simply opened up a dialogue. We invited students to share their stories of how gun violence has personally impacted their own lives, and we invited other students to share their opinions on what our legislators need to do in order to protect us and ensure that this issue comes to an end. Ultimately, what we see is that student activism is incredibly important, but is often belittled. Later that day, I saw many comments online from people saying that we didn't know why we were there, or that we were doing it just to get out of class. But if you were down there, you would know that none of these things are true. And just as our involvement in civic discourse is important, so too is our activism and our actual involvement. We're inheriting a world that has made significant societal progress, but still has a very long way to go. In South America, indigenous people are being stripped of the rights to their land. In 2015, we did achieve marriage equality, but in Idaho in 2019, we still have not added the words gender identity and sexual orientation to our state's Human Rights Act. We've made significant strides in gender equality, but the gender pay gap continues to grow. And in February of this year, our legislature killed a bill that would have ended child marriage in the state of Idaho. Clearly, we have a long way to go. And it doesn't simply mean that we leave our opinions at the ballot box. It means that we remain active and engaged citizens throughout our years and throughout our lives, because these things are incredibly important and we have to work tirelessly to change them. So it's time to teach students and young people that it's okay to discuss political and controversial issues. Let's encourage them to attend demonstrations and to form their own opinions. Let's stop telling students that they don't deserve a voice in our political conversations or that they don't know what they're talking about. We need an actively engaged population at all levels of government and across all age groups. We need to let our legislators and our lawmakers know that we care about these issues and that we care deeply about them. And we do this by attending demonstrations, by attending protests, and letting our voices be heard. Let's change the structures that we've been born into. Let's rewrite the stories that we've been telling for far too long. Let's change the mindsets that are leading to dampened discourse, and let's create a more informed, more open, and more engaged society that fights for the human rights of all citizens. Thank you.
Thank you, Garrett. That was great. Thank you, Garrett, and go Bora.
Like Marilyn Schuller, Cherie Buckner-Webb has lived her life as an example of her commitment to the rights of all, whether it be color, gender, class, or income. Cherie is joining us just a couple weeks after knee surgery, so it makes it even more special to have her here, and we're going to give her extra time to get up to the podium. In my experience with both Cherie and with Marilyn, they could communicate to you that you had disappointed them without actually ever telling you. And I see a few heads nodding. But this is a woman who has moral authority that comes not from being in the Idaho legislature. In fact, Cherie had this power of personality long before she came to the Idaho House in 2010 or to the Idaho Senate in 2012, where she now serves as Assistant Minority Leader. In 2011, when my colleague Marcia Franklin interviewed Cherie for Public Television's Color of Conscience documentary, Marcia asked, "Why did you want to work in the legislature, which is a very white body?" "Well," said Cherie, "I've been operating in a very white body my whole life." But I think the power that she has comes from being able to navigate regardless of color and regardless of body. Cherie's grandfather came to Idaho in the early 1900s and built St. Paul's Baptist Church with the help of his father or his father-in-law? His father-in-law. So this is a family with deep roots in Idaho. That's the church that was moved from Broadway over to Julia Davis Park, which is now the Idaho Black History Museum, which is operated or executive directed by Philip Thompson, her son, who is with us today. Cherie was born in Boise and graduated Boise High School. She worked as a singer and as a management in management at both HP and Boise Cascade. And now she operates her own consulting company and works with companies around the country. And I was going to say, so I'll repeat it again, she just got knee replacement surgery, and she is here with us regardless of that. So please welcome Cherie Buckner-Webb.
Thank you. I am so glad to be with you today. Have mercy. And you know what? I was giving the young man a bad time about Bora High. You can come to Boise High anytime you want to, because, honey, you rocked it. You rocked it. I'm going to tell everybody, I know you. You're my best friend. He did a heck of a job, did he? Did he? That's right. That's right. All right. Oh, my goodness. It's my great honor to be here, particularly at this Marilyn Schuller Forum on Human Rights. I had the opportunity to go to Northern Idaho 2 weeks ago when I really wasn't supposed to be out of bed yet. And I said, oh, you know, it's a hour flight up, an hour flight back, I'll sleep. Don't do it. Don't do it. Don't do it. You know, Marilyn was a unique individual, an activist, an educator, a catalyst, a sister, an innovator, an instigator, a visionary, and so, so much more. She touched lives that she'll never know that she touched over and over and over again. And her legacy continues, and that's what we have to do. It's not about sitting on the sidelines saying, I knew Garrett. I need to get up and do what Garrett just asked for. Let me say it again. I need to get up out of my seat, and do what Garrett just asked for. I don't think you heard me. We need to get up out of our seat and do that work that... One black woman, she knew to come. You got it. Thank you so much, so much. Let me say it again. We need to get up out of our seat, on our feet, and do what Garrett just asked. Let me hear you. That's it. He's not here just to waste his time. He's here to invigorate, to elevate, to encourage, to show you that he's doing his job. Now you do yours. I'm so glad you had the good sense not to say when I was born, because then I was thinking I was going to just take this chance. But just because we're of a certain age doesn't mean that our work is done yet. There is work for all of us to do in this wonderful state in which we live, and we talk about doing human rights, and sometimes I think our ego gets tied up. Well, back in 74, I walked the line with, I don't know, somebody's dead. I voted back in 65. Well, good for you. But you're not done yet. Say it. I'm not done yet. Turn to the person next to you, because they're going to remember, and say, I'm not done yet. Ha ha, hell, I'm not done yet. All right, we're not done yet, but you still have to do your part. And I mean, this is just so important, and I'm kind of coming to you from a hard line, because it was... I don't know if my leg hurt. At first, I thought it was my behind that was hurting me in the end of the legislature. But then I found out it was really my leg. But there's neck and neck, if you know what I'm talking about. Oh, my Lord. Oh, it made you want to sing slave songs sitting up in there. And people that took my place said, oh, I'm so honored you asked me the first week. We have work to do. We have work to do. And we are responsible and we are accountable. We care about what's happening. We need to stand up and show it. We can't only say it quietly in the background, but rather we must come forward and stand for something. Because if you stand for nothing, you'll fall for anything, which we also saw demonstrated in this past year. So we don't want to keep that up. You know, Marilyn's one of the things that she was most encouraging about was the provision of education and human rights. The support of those who were victimized. You know, I think a lot of people get confused about human rights and what it means to be victimized, what it means to be monitoring, supporting the promotion of the celebration of diversity. It's not just barbecue on barbecue. I just said that from you. Get that. When I say barbecue, you must think the black folks are doing something, because it's y'all can cook barbecue. It's all right. But it's much more than that. It's much more than having a day for dinner, a day for this or whatever. I'm going to go have Mexican food because it's Cinco de Mayo. It's much more than that. But it's still a wonderful opportunity to unite with people you might not otherwise do that, to unite with them and have congruent, meaningful, joyful, challenging, even asking stupid questions brings about synergies. It is so important to converse, to have a conversation. The young kids say a convo. Those kids were standing in front of that school, and they were talking about issues that will be important for the next generation. And I'm so supportive of those young people at Boise High and other schools around here at Bora High, Capitol High, because I've got this one and one only granddaughter, and she is a trip. She's 8. I think she's 30. I don't know. I don't know where she gets this attitude, but she got attitude. I think you meant so-and-so. I know her daddy. But I'm just saying, I want the best for that child. I want the best for your child and your grandchild. I want us to be the best we can be. And in order for that to happen, we have work to do. I want you to walk out this door today thinking, I have work to do. You cannot be lax about it. Marilyn believed in conversation among divergent groups. She was a truth teller. Do you assume the people with whom you interact are truth tellers? No answer, Do you assume they are truth tellers? I'm concerned because I think that when I was a youngster, you assumed that everyone was on the same page and we were all looking toward the greater good and it was going. Now, not so much. I think the news and things that we see in the media have us really tied up, and we're almost locking ourselves away instead of having those congruent conversations. It's important. She believed in conversation among diverse groups. She was fearless, she was powerful, and yet respectful. She had that just wonderful little light voice, and you thought, oh, I can take her. Not so. I am so honored to come before you today to invite you to join me in honoring Marilyn's work while doing your own work and making a positive difference in the world in which we live. I remember the first time I heard the Pledge of Allegiance in the first grade. Do you remember that? First grade? And you knew it really, and you knew it in a hurry, and I thought, this is big stuff. Everybody was quiet, including me, which is not often. We were quiet, and we were reverent, and I listened to the words, and I can remember when I talked to my mom about it in the first grade. That must be big stuff. Nobody talked about it. What is it? Just hearing the words with liberty and justice for all was empowering to me at age 6. And yet, it wasn't long before I was aware. I wasn't out of the sixth grade before I realized while we call ourselves a beacon of fairness and equality, there were many people in my first grade classroom that were not treated equally. There were young people who lived in my neighborhood, who lived around the corner from me, who were not treated equitably. Now, when somebody burned a cross in our yard, I didn't think of it as being different and being me. I just thought somebody was confused. It was a time passed before I realized, yeah, it was really directed at my family. Oh, my gosh. And then I started noticing things that happened. Who got called on in classes? Did the guys get called on first, or did the girls get called on? If girls talked over boys, what did that mean? Shame on them. But the boys could talk over everybody, and I could talk over all of them, so they need to get, I'm just saying, it was really an interesting dynamic that I noticed early on. I pledge allegiance to the flag of the United States of America and to the republic for which it stands, one nation under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. It sounds powerful, but yet inequity and injustice prevails. And if we're not vigilant, if we don't continue to access justice at every turn, we will become more and more removed from what the meaning of justice is and what it looks like and what it feels like and who it applies to. There was a thing on Facebook the other day. I've had a lot of time for Facebook. I'm just reading, oh, his mother did that. Oh, he did that. I'm going to write him and tell her that he didn't. No, I could do that. But I mean, I really got stuffed in. There was a gentleman that I've known for a long time, and he sent me a copy of a Facebook post from a young woman who's an educator, was at Boise State University for a long period of time, and she said, I've lived here for 6 years. I'm not trying to out her here. And I've always thought, wow, I wasn't going to come to Boise, but I did ultimately come to Boise, worked at Boise State for a time. She's not there now, and thought it was a great opportunity. And she said, hey, she's an African-American woman, said, man, I never would have believed it. Her mother was one of those that called me and asked me, do I want my baby to come to Idaho? Because she'd heard about Northern Idaho. And I spent time with her telling them all the wonderful things that I found about Idaho and how I love it. Anyway, the woman wrote in her Facebook post that she'd been here for 6 years. And last weekend, she found out why people were afraid to be in Idaho. She was standing with her girlfriends, had come out to dinner, had a wonderful time, and people on the corner started throwing derogatory remarks at them. Not just throwing them at them, but following them along. It's no exception in Boise. It's no exception in Cascade. It's no exception anywhere. But we have to be vigilant. And we also have to stand up. Even if we're outside it, you're not talking to me. Don't get comfortable, because tomorrow it could be you. Tomorrow it could be your child. We have work to do. We have work to do. Teachable moments, teachable moments. We must work collectively and collaboratively to ensure that every member of society does have equal rights. Now, they may not all look the same, but the opportunity to blow it, to win it, to do what they can, to contribute as best they can, we have a job to do, and we have to make a way to do that. Many of the people in this room have been here a long period of time. Many are newcomers, but in every single instance, you have an opportunity. Sometimes it's just to call out what is inappropriate. Sometimes it's just to stand up and say, listen to me. I'm a young kid today, but I'm not going to be a young kid tomorrow. Am I telling the truth? And I have vision that you don't have, Cherie. And I have experiences that you don't have, Yvonne. That I'm walking in a different walk than you are over and over again. Because a lot of people spend a lot of time saying, I didn't know. Well, I would hate for my dear friend Jill Gill to miss an experience that might be very valuable for her because I hadn't said, did you know? Say amen. Say amen. Friends, pretend like you're at my house. Say amen.
Amen.
Oh, my goodness. You know, I like white folks, but y'all, it's just so hard on a girl. It's hard on a girl, but I can do that. Yeah. I'm sorely disappointed that my legislature, who I chose to serve in our legislature, I think that we responded very poorly to a number of things. I am sorely dismayed about a number of things we did or did not do this year and the poor excuses we gave for doing them. So one of the things I would say to you, it's not them or us that did it. We're in this together. So if I repeatedly, who's the gentleman that talked to me today? If you can continually elect somebody and they continually do exactly what you don't want them to do, what's the opportunity here, folks?
Vote them out.
I mean, if I continually do the same thing the same way and you still hate it, I'm just saying you have a job to do. It's my great hope that we stop and take stock together about what we're supposed to do. Thurgood Marshall, anybody know who Thurgood Marshall is? Oh, I'm so happy. He said to protest against injustice is the foundation of all American democracy. It's not a bad thing. It's not a good thing. It's the right that we have. It's a right that we have. In the words of Dr. Martin Luther King Jr., justice denied anywhere diminishes justice everywhere. We saw a few years ago that some students in a small town in Idaho victimized a young man who was, I believe he was autistic. We did terrible things to that young man. And adults that were responsible and accountable for that young man turned their heads. And they were allowed to turn their heads. We've been trying to add the words. We've changed the name. We've come up with different nomenclature. We've tried all kinds of things to get it passed. And all we're saying is every person should have the right to be treated equitably, not specially, not differently, not uniquely. I mean, I pledge allegiance to the flag, one nation under God, indivisible, with liberty and justice for all. How hard is that? I can remember when I talked to my granddaughter, who is now 8, about that. What do you think when you hear liberty and justice for all? She says, everybody, even John should have it. Who's John? That's this guy in her class that's really giving her a bad time. Even John. Now, she's 8, and she's got this. How hard is it for us? How hard is it? How hard is it? You know, I mean, Billie Holiday had a song a long time ago, and it was, them that's got shall gain, them that's not shall lose. So the Bible says, but it still is news. Mama may have, Papa may have, but God bless the child that's got his own. And that was kind of a real, that's way over my, that's way before me. But that's kind of a scary song that says that them that's got, get, and them that don't got, ain't gonna get, ain't never gonna have it. And that's the way we've been carrying ourselves. And I'm sorry to hear that. I'm sorry to hear that. But I believe we can stop it. We can stop it. Let's think about what unites us and what divides us. So what unites us? Race, religion, country of origin, education, color, who we love, where we live, politics, athletics, apathy. What divides us? Race, religion, country of origin, education, color, who we love, where we live, politics, apathy. You hear what I'm saying? So we can find any reason that we want to discriminate negatively towards somebody or to make an opportunity for someone. So I'm telling you now, somebody made a way for you, or you wouldn't be at this room at this time, at this place. And you have a responsibility to do the same. Marilyn, in so many ways, inspired me. She just, when she was in her last days here on this earth, and I think many of us got, did you get a call from Marilyn? Who got a call from Marilyn? Yeah, because Marilyn was telling you what she wanted you to do when she was gone and how soon you should take care of it, right? You know, I like that about her. If there's something you really think needs to be done, call them out by name and say it where there's an audience so you really have to do it. I thought that's funny. But it's really important to ask for what is needed. Who loves living in Boise, Idaho? I am so proud of Boise, Idaho. Who loves it? So do you not have a responsibility to this bigger thing, this Boise, Idaho? Do you not have a responsibility to this Idaho to make it welcoming? You don't have to love everybody, but you can treat them as individuals with dignity and respect. I don't have to love you. Sometimes I'm not sure how I feel about Philip. But I, you know, did the best I could with that child. But, you know, I mean, sometimes we really, it's time that we join together to form a mighty militia. Champions of compassion. Emissaries for equality, ambassadors for humanity, zealots for liberty, warriors for justice. Those are all fighting words, and they're all good words. Champions for compassion. How often do you think of that word in your daily life, compassion? Not too many. Any preachers in the house? Because they use it pretty much. I mean, we can use it. You can co-opt that. I'm proud to be a soldier in that army, and I'm undergirded, supported, and empowered. I'm undergirded by an understanding of our interconnectedness. A lot of time we spend differentiating each other from one another. What I'd like us to think about is our interconnectedness, an inheritance of the demonstrated courageous actions of the legions who came before us. And just as they made a way for us, we must make a way for others. I'm supported by men and women who are committed from across the world. A host of individuals with powerful history of striving to ensure that each and every human being is being treated with dignity and respect. Dignity and respect. It doesn't have to be somebody you know. If you see somebody walking down the street and they do something that is offensive to you, and if it was your mother or your sister or your cousin or the other that they were doing that to, you would intercede. Why not intercede now? I mean, you can get a safe distance and intercede. I ain't crazy. You know what I'm saying? But you can intercede. I think it's important. I'm empowered by a vision for a future, not only for the next generation, not just for my children or my grandchildren, I'm hoping there'll be another sometime, but rather for 7 generations to come, because truly what we do today sets the foundation. Sets the foundation. So what's in your arsenal to make sure that it comes to fruition? Collaboration, influence, knowledge, expertise. Name a couple. What's in your arsenal? What else? What's in your toolkit to bring about change that you want to see? Yes. She cares. Have mercy. What else? Grace. 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 Love. History. Kindness. Pardon?
I'm sorry. Say it one more time.
A voice. Oh, that. A voice. Okay. Unique sensibilities, diverse perspectives, perspectives, the power to choose, the power to act, a purpose, the desire to make the trip together. And so this is all I ask you to do, easy stuff. I want you to do six little things, and you can get this done. You won't have to be scared. You can call your next-door neighbor, your wife, your mother, your sister, your cousin, whoever will stand with you and say, first of all, stand up. Stand up, gentlemen over there. Stand up. Commit and take action against acts of hatred and in support of those victimized. Number two is to show up. You got to be there. You've got to be attending, participating, fully representing your values. Number three, sometimes a challenge for me, there'll be times you need to shut up. Yeah, it's funny, huh? Okay. You'll need to speak up, find your voice, and use it effectively. And there are many times that we don't take advantage of this one, but we must make up. Because we can step in it, we can step on it, we can make missteps. And with fervent, dedicated, real opportunity, you can make up with others. And finally, find that power greater than yourself. Stay connected and look up. And the last one, number seven, is you'll have to take time where you are right now when you're almost 40. your trajectory may be a little bit different than when you're 35 or when you're 55 or when you're 65. So you'll need to re-up. What can I best be doing now? Did your parents talk about when they retired very much? I never heard the word retirement very much. My grandfather Johnson was still working when he was like 92. He retired 3-4 times from the different place. They just let him keep staying. I mean, folks didn't think about when can I get to when I stop? When can I get to the next opportunity for me? And so I just say to you as I stand here today, take Marilyn's sensibilities to your heart. Where there's fear, look for courage. Where there's doubt, look for confidence. Where there's disagreement, bring resolution, because the answer is each and every one of you. Thanks very much. This is the best. We've got your questions and your solutions and your answers and all kinds of stuff.
Well, thank you, Sheree. That was terrific. And for our radio audience, you are listening to Sheree Buckner-Webb, Idaho State Senator, speaking at the Human Rights Forum in the memory of Marilyn Schuler. Discrimination in Idaho, that's a North Idaho issue. Why are we worried about it in Boise?
Discrimination is alive and well throughout our country, throughout our city, throughout our churches, throughout our communities, throughout our neighborhoods. It's there. But we can do what we can do. What we can do. We can do what we can do to eradicate that.
So as you experience Idaho, do you get this where Boise is this blue island, this liberal blue island, the problem is elsewhere in Idaho. Do you hear that? And what do you say to people when you hear that?
I have tons and tons of opportunities to show you clearly and firsthand that it's not in other parts of Idaho, but it's everywhere in Idaho. Go to any grade school, and I want you to know that children don't learn some of the words that they share with other children at school. Other nicknames they use. They don't use some of the pejoratives that they throw around in school. They don't learn them there. We can find anywhere people are gathered together. We have work to do. And I'm not looking for a fight. I'm not looking for some big melee, but rather that we can interrupt some of those things. We can stand up.
We have a number of questioners about Add the Words, so including one from a Boise High School student. What's it going to take for Idaho and the legislature to actually take that next step?
Well, I'll tell you that I'm really proud of many of our legislators, and I'm not so proud of some of our legislators. It looks like we work very hard to find excuses not to do things that we know that are the right thing. The thing that really jammed us up this time, they kept bringing religious priorities as having greater importance than human rights. And
lots of discussion, people that they brought in from Washington, D.C. to have conversations with some of us. And I'm sorry, it just didn't bode well for me because every person has the right to live their life to the fullest. And I don't think your religion is an excuse for that. The freedom of religion is in our Constitution. It's you can worship or not worship. But I don't think it should be directive about what we do in the civil discourse.
So for an audience for whom that's a big issue, what needs to happen? What can you do? What can they do? What does Idaho need to do to get past that?
I wish we could just make it so. And I think some of the things, because religion is a real sacred, if you will, conversation with folks, and seldom do we really have those authentic conversations about things that are so sacrosanct as religion. And sometimes we find, you know, I know this is going to come as a shock to you, but I'm married to a preacher. One never knows. Okay. It gets confusing sometimes. It's not either or. It can be and both, and it can work very well. My son is of a different faith than I am. And we go to his church. He goes to my church. We work quite well. My granddaughter knows the vernacular of all, and it's possible to work very clearly together. We got to have some reasonable conversations. You had that right on.
So one questioner asks, has there been less civility in the legislature this year? And if so, why?
I'm looking to some of my colleagues. Is it yes or no? What'd she say?
Yes.
Less civility? Yeah, I was thinking, I was trying to find a nice word for less civility. Good God Almighty. We have just been, I mean, it's really hard to talk about civil conversations when we're not even demonstrating it ourselves. I'm crushed by that because we have a responsibility to lead it, and we've been doing all this thing about civil discourse, but I guess we just read it and stick it in the closet or something. We have work to do. We are not leading in that direction.
How much energy do you feel individuals should commit to global human rights versus local human rights? Should efforts start at home to be effective?
You know, anywhere you take a stand and you do what you're supposed to do, I don't care where it starts. I don't care if it's your back door, if it's your neighborhood. Just do it. Do it. I mean, there's no rules that say you can only be nice here or this has to come first and this could be second. I think where the opportunity arises, stand up, and make your voice heard. It's not to say it can only happen in one environment.
So to pick up on that, one of our questioners asked not just what it would take to get the words added to the law, the Human Rights Act in Idaho, but it feels like we are taking steps backwards with the Supreme Court ruling on whether civil rights law banned discrimination, et cetera, et cetera. Is it your sense that we're going backwards instead of forwards?
Seems like we're doing everything we can to circumvent. I mean, we had hoped that maybe even we would see something better on a national level. That didn't happen. That was a hope that was standing out there for a period of time because we knew that we weren't moving very much forward in Idaho. And again, I hope that people understand what we're trying to do because we have, I don't know how many municipalities have passed it and nothing blew up. You know what I mean? People are still going to school and going to work. Everything's working out. But it's those that have not passed it yet that seem to be having some difficulty. I think in some ways we are going back, but we don't have to do that. We can stop this train from going backwards.
So you travel around the country for your business, and you tell the story about people being surprised when you say, "Hi, I'm from Idaho." And in fact, you said, well, maybe I'm answering my own question, but you're not sure whether you get more surprise from black folk than white folk.
I'm so glad you said black folk right out there. You did that. Good job. Good job.
I'm working.
Most people
on it.
Just tiptoe, you know, y'all, you know. And that's really true. It's really true. I mean, you know, I'll be working with a client system and whatever, and we do all the negotiating, and we get there, and I walk in the door, and we start to have the conversations, and they go, oh. One guy, it was really funny, he goes, "Oh, you're Cherie?" "Yes, I'm Cherie." "You're so tall." "I'm not that tall." And so I go out of my way to say, yes, there are black folks in Idaho, five, all related to me. And I mean, when I worked in Emmett, when I first went to work in Emmett, I worked in the sawmill. That was one of the other really experiences. It was fun for me because someone came to me that was head of the NAACP and said, "Do you know that they have laws that say you can't be on the street of Emmett?" And I said, "Good news, I can leave at 4:30." No, but it did cause me a little consternation because those laws were still on the books, and we need to make sure we're a little bit careful about that. I wore red stuff to work all the time so they could see where I was parking.
Well, I mean, just you touring a sawmill is an interesting image in general, but you told a story about you're getting a tour of the sawmill, and you get to a point where the general manager, whoever's taking you on the tour, decides he needs to take you back to the office and end the tour. So tell that story.
Okay, so I had four areas, and I'd finally gotten up to council, and this is a wonderful community, and he was a great leader. This is quite a while ago. And so I looked to see where they, you know, somebody's cut down the tree. I figured that out. Then they have the log. Then they're taking the stumps off the log, and they're da-da-da-da-da. And then he said, "Come on, we're going to get up in the sawyer's box, and you'll see how it comes down the line," and I'm watching it come down the line. And then he says, "And then I noticed the sawyer who's running all the machinery, his ears are getting real red, because y'all give yourselves away, I just got to tell you, you know, red ears, and pretty soon his nose is getting red, and all of a sudden," and he goes, "Cherie, we just have to go back to the office. We have to leave." And I'm going, "What's with this?" And he said, "Well, I just have to tell you, that next piece of equipment's called a nigger that turns the log." And I said, "We'll be calling it a log turner if you ever want service from me, you know." So we can change the vernacular even where we are, because I was the purchasing guy. You're going to get nothing if you ask me for a log turner that's going to... But some of the stuff that's come to be into our vernacular, we do have to remove. We do have to remove it. And it's possibly at one time it was meant to be very derogatory, maybe not, whatever, but I know that it won't stand where I'm working. So
this Boise High student asks, how do you face and overcome opposition in your life, in the legislature, elsewhere?
Well, I think, again, we use all the tools that are at our fingertips. One of the things the gentleman did, what's his name? I've forgotten his name. Garrett, right? So Garrett has the gift of gab. He's very articulate. He talks with rapidity, and he talks with clarity. That's one of the things he's got going on. Apparently, he's a little bit fearless, and he's still going on. Someone else may use their grace that somebody talked about. They use their grace. Someone may use humor. Some may use the ability to gather many people together. Whatever works for you, I think that's what you have to use. And I think it's very important to utilize lots of different ways, because you can't hit everybody the same way. You know, and then sometimes, maybe it's not best for me to speak, because I can get jacked up about stuff. I get excited. Ooh. And for example, I might call on Senator Jordan. I go, "You talk to him first. He's going to be a dead man," you know. And vice versa. You use the tools that are available for you. And I mean, that's mostly talking trash. Now, see, don't leave here and say, "Cherie's going to go get a gun. I don't have a gun." It's not none of that. But I mean, I think that there are stereotypes that persist. So sometimes you use the face and the voice of another one that is on the same page. When we were going through a lot of legislation this year about other issues, particularly about health care, you would think health care, everybody in the world is going to be yay for health care. And I want to tell you, I was floored that it got so much consternation. So we need our friends and our foes, and I mean both, to sometimes give us that other opinion and that other view of the landscape, so we can make good decisions on how we will navigate those waters.
This questioner put stars at the top, stars for Garrett. So well done, Garrett. And then says, what do you think of the idea that came out of Oregon, which is changing the voting age to 16?
Now, let's see. We'll let women get married when they're 12. Okay, so I exaggerated a little bit. We're doing some really unique things here in Idaho. And I'm going to go get my... What do I think about it? I think we wouldn't let them smoke, but we would let them have guns. And I mean, we're really operating at a deficit, is the worst I can say. We are a thoughtful, educated, erudite people in Idaho. I'm proud of our education system, and it's growing by leaps and bounds. We got to insert this tool that we have to think long term and to think, what is the need for some of these things? Some of this stuff is just amazing to me.
Well, you sound like a politician and you're avoiding an answer.
No, that's called dancing. Dancing. What do I think about it?
Age 16.
Age 16 to do what?
To vote.
I would tell you that in a lot of instances, I bet we get a lot, no disrespect to those above age 16, we might get a lot more thoughtful voting done because they're voting for their futures. Those kids would be really doing their homework. And I would appreciate that instead of voting for the one that has the same letter that I voted for forever and whatever the politics for that environment has changed. We need to stay up to speed. So, I mean, there's some 16-year-olds, I say, bring it. There's some 16-year-olds, like, you know, so.
We talked about your grandfather. Your mother was a big influence on you, right? I've heard Philip talk about she was kind of the fiery one in the family that was demanding action and not.
Yeah, she was on the other side of the aisle. That's the other side of the family. My dad's family was very kind and well-behaved. My mother's not so much. And she was on the first civil rights action that we had on the Capitol steps. And it was really interesting. So many people were terrified about taking an action. This is, again, I didn't know what I didn't know. I grew up believing that you could make a stand, and we've been seeing it all over the news and all that kind of stuff. And I was pretty young then. I was about 16. That was your right to come and stand up for what you believed. But I heard at my church that many, many people believed it was our right to do that, but most people wouldn't go. They were going to hold prayer meetings because they were afraid their lives, their jobs, and their futures would be at stake. So
that was that 1968 protest on the stage of the Capitol, stairs of the Capitol, when...
You put the 68 so they could count it, right? Thanks so much.
And well, I'm quick enough.
No, go ahead.
But the governor refused to lower the flag after the death of Martin Luther King, right?
So that, Governor Samuelson.
That was the first civil rights rally in Idaho?
That I know of. Is that correct?
In Boise.
Yeah.
Okay.
We call my lifeline there. Thank you so much. And it was pretty well attended by when you realize that the numbers were very small. But there was a lot of fear. We realized, I can't remember who the chief of police was then, that probably more policemen were attending than were citizens of the community.
So I don't want to give away your age, but in 1968, you would have been a teenager.
Yes,
I was. And there's a photo in the Black History Museum of that moment where you are singing. And was that the first protest you'd attended?
Yeah, in Boise that I did, the first one that I did in Boise. My mother, during some other times, had gotten with a gentleman named, not gotten with a gentleman, she toured other colleges. My daddy went, okay. When they were protesting things in the civil rights movement, too, she did a lot of universities, and there were other things going on in the college community that didn't necessarily go on there, but I'd gone with her to a number of those. She was my founding grace for that kind of stuff, yeah.
So for our radio audience, we're with Cherie Buckner-Webb speaking at the City Club of Boise Forum on Human Rights in Memory of Marilyn Schuller. Here's a question. It's a long one, but it's really thoughtful. You speak of an army or a militia to do what brings justice and liberty for all. Just a few days ago, there was a group on the State House steps, the 3% rally, using very similar argument for very different objectives. Both sides believe they are doing what is right. How do we come to a just outcome?
Well, we won't come to any kind of just outcome if we're not talking to each other. A really wonderful thing that happened to me, just I think it was 3 days before I left to go have my surgery. I won't even give you the precipitating things, but there were a number of 3%ers that were in the Capitol quite a bit. And one day my attaché said, the 3%ers are looking for you, but I didn't tell them you're going to be here. And I said, no, I'd like to meet them. That'd be great. And so when I was going downstairs, they said, okay, they came. I'm not wrapped up in that label. That doesn't bother me either. I could have said, black folks, and scared them to death, but I didn't. But they did come to my office. There were three wonderful, just wonderful gentlemen. We had a great conversation. We learned something about each other. The first flowers I received on my front steps were from them, and so clearly my address is out in public. but it was a thoughtful conversation, and I was surprised at some things I didn't know, and then learned some things we did know. They very well can fit on either side of the political dynamics, depending on what the issue is. And they were really—it was really a thoughtful moment. I loved that. I loved that. Then they met my kid, and my grandkid was there too. And I said, "No, don't mess up. This is my grandbaby." No, they were really great. They were great. So I mean, we got to first of all stop making assumptions about who people are, what they believe, what they will do, because a label means nothing. A label to me means something different to you. And I mean, geez, we got to have those interactions.
This questioner asks or says, you are very clearly successful, and yet so many blacks feel they are oppressed. Your story is an inspiration. Say more about the obstacles you have overcome.
Well, I think one of the things that's really important for me, and again, it's my mother's story, is she taught me to expect obstacles. And she said, why would you not have obstacles? Everybody I know has obstacles. They may be different. Some may have fewer in a given arena, but you got to go out and get what you've got and do the best you can with what you can. So I was not surprised when obstacles arose. I mean, I know there are a lot of women out here that I know in this audience that are younger than me, but we, during the big women's movement, we thought we had that thing, we had that thing whacked. We knew how to do everything, but we didn't necessarily share that information with the next generation. And unfortunately, because we didn't share some of the learnings that we'd received as we were going through the ranks of corporate America, the next generation was found flat-footed and was just shocked to find out they were going through the same pile of mess that we did. So we have a responsibility to share what we learn, to be available to do what, not to do their work, but to tell them what we learn, and so that they can take that information to, and I think that's the same with a woman of color, a male of color, someone that's different, any kind of way different. We've got to share the information and be willing to share it.
You mentioned that when you were a young girl, there had been a cross burned on your family yard in Boise. Your dad wanted to get rid of it, but what did your mother do?
My mother had a fit. My mom, we were having dinner, and you can't leave the table for dinner, except mom out of nowhere said, come here, Buck. He runs outside, and you could see in the neighbor across the street, you could see a huge fire in their window, and we thought the fire was in their house, but rather it was in our front yard. And my dad was just a real, he was not a confrontational guy. He wanted to hurry up and get it out, get it in the alley so nobody could see it. My mom insisted that he put it out and put it on the front porch. And she used words that I won't share here and said, the young people or the people or the neighbors are late. We've been here a year. You know, let's leave it right here. And we left it for a year, and it was a great teaching moment. One of the interesting things that happens, I don't know if I've ever shared this with you, I was in the House for 2 years, and then I was in the Senate 2 years later. I went into the Senate, and my first day of my Senate tenure, a very tall gentleman came to my door, and he just walked right in. And I've got to tell you, I have a little bit of carefulness, even like when I'm knocking on doors at night. I don't knock on the door and get right up to, they always tell you, when you're knocking on doors, get right up in their face. Oh, no, I won't. No. I always step back. So this gentleman came right in, very comfortable, closed the door, and I said, please excuse me, who are you? And he said, well, do you remember when your parents had a cross burn on their front yard? So now my heart's going, yes, I do remember that. And he said, well, my uncle was the police officer that took that call, and I wonder if you'd like to know some more that happened with that. He knew who was arrested. He knew what happened. He knew all that kind of stuff. And then in an education committee meeting this year, another gentleman came up, and this was the policeman's nephew that said, we all knew you guys, and we knew your dad. We went to college with him at Boise Junior College. But it's really funny how, I guess there weren't too many of us, so we didn't shake y'all up. We only had like five or six, but they kind of welcomed us and encouraged us. But there was this group of folks that were looking out for us that we didn't even know that was happening. That was really kind of an interesting thing. And to end up in the Capitol and to hear these people two times over a period of 20 years is really validating.
So did you feel then, or I guess feel now, that the incident was taken seriously by the police and by the government, and And you felt like your family got treated well by the system when it happened?
Well, a couple things. My mom was a hellraiser, so I was pretty sure they were going to hear us. And my dad was a long-term Boisean, and he lived here forever and went to school with lots of people, and that was another piece of it. So the combination, we didn't feel that we were overlooked or shunned or anything like that. But you know that people can do an amount of work in any endeavor, and some feels adequate and some doesn't. So whatever their intention was, it felt affirming to me, as it did to both my parents. Now, the grandparents and aunts and uncles all wanted us to move out of the North End to move back down to the River Street area. They wanted us out quick. And Mom said no.
You've mentioned a couple times the small number of small black population in Idaho now, and especially when you were young. And so talk to us about how that makes growing up black different than if you were in a big city with a large African American population. I think Jill Gill says as long as people knew their place, there was no problem.
And if there wasn't a critical mass, the mainstream dominant culture isn't threatened by you. But if the number grows exponentially over a short period of time, then it's suddenly, I mean, we're seeing that with some of our immigrant populations. They're being treated really rough because they're unknown to us, we're assuming they're going to treat us like maybe we treated them, and that's really unfortunate. That isn't necessarily the thing. What we have to do is be open to, again, bridge that gap, have that conversation, because, I mean, that could be fearful for them, it could be fearful for us, but if we don't have the conversations, it's never going to improve. But when there's a small amount, I was trying to find a date. I didn't know what to do. But it was Mountain Home Air Force, yes. Okay. That was some of the things that's different. Small number.
So that made you especially unusual, right? I mean, if you grew up in Oakland or somewhere in the South, there would be a large community of people like you. But talk about what it was like feeling like there weren't a lot of people like you.
There weren't, and yet there's a small community of which we were, which was very insular, the black church, so and so and so and so, that we did have an extended community, an extended family, that I can't really speak to what it would have been like in a large community, but I did tell to my children when they were growing up, their dad's from Atlanta, Georgia, and I kept saying, you know, if you lived in Atlanta, the numbers would be so large and the opportunities so small, you may have never had the opportunities you've realized here because there were lots of other people. So I think it worked out well for them, and I think about that a lot. When the numbers are great and when we have some of those affirmative action things that people say, look what we did, affirmative action, yeah, but let me tell you what the numbers do and how that rolls out. So we have to think about getting the best we can out of what's going on and those that are missing it on either hand to speak to it.
So you said that there's no questions that are too dumb. So I'm going to ask you a personal question. What did you say when you heard that your son was becoming a Muslim?
What do I have to do? That was the first thing I asked. My mother believed that every summer you had to study one religion, one major religion. And Philip's always been my kind of step outside the box kid. Yeah. And so he came to us after he got to the Muslim faith, and he announced that he was going to join. It wasn't frightening or anything like that. Now, the Buckner side was like, oh, no, my baby, because they were all the preachers that did all the thing, you know what I mean? And they were, oh, it was really interesting, and I just wanted to know what I had to wear. Just wanted to be clear, and I didn't know if there was a baptism, and he goes, you got the wrong church, Mom. I didn't know there was this or that, the other. I just didn't know what I didn't know, and so that was concerning to me. I didn't know what, let's see, Philip, was that before the big bombing, I mean the New York thing, was it before? Yeah, so we'd had the New York bombing and all that kind of stuff. So I was really frightened. Then I worked for Hewlett-Packard then, and we had some folks that were Muslim that were living with us, working for us, that were having to really monitor how they flew in and out of the country and all that kind of stuff. So I was frightened for him because he had this look that people didn't know. He was wearing his hair kind of long then, and I thought, they don't know. Wear a note that says, I'm a black kid from Boise. You know, I was worried. I'm serious, because some people come up and talk to him. When we came up the elevator just a minute, a gentleman spoke He spoke Arabic to me. I wasn't sure which. And Philip did back. And I go, gosh, how can you guys tell each other? That's what people do to black folks, too. I mean, I'm being kind of facetious. You know, you go through an airport, and there's black people you've never seen. You go, hey, hey, and they go, hey, back. It's kind of an acknowledgement. There's kind of an acknowledgement when you see people that are like you some way. Do you know, there's a nice connectedness. There's a connectedness. So while it's funny in some ways, that was my concern. Not so much for his safety, a little bit for his safety, because that was really scary for me. And then I remember when he was young, it was, I hope you'll, Philip is, yeah, I hope you'll meet a nice young woman. And then I said, I hope you'll meet a nice black woman. Then I said, I hope you'll meet a nice person. That you, because you know you grow, don't you? That will make your life. I hope somebody can put up with you, Philip. Was ultimately what it was. I don't care where she goes, what she does, or if it's a he or a she. Just they gotta like your mother best. So.
I feel like we're getting into family counseling here. You mentioned, Cinco de Mayo. You know, having Mexican food on Cinco de Mayo, or having barbecue food on Juneteenth, or don't you sometimes get a little disappointed at cultural appropriation? White people wrapping themselves in these trappings to steal the story or make your experience less legitimate?
Well, I don't think they can take my experience and make it less legitimate. They can do what they want to do with it, but I have a role and responsibility to tell them what it means to me. And how that has positively impacted me, or what that does. And if having a rib or two with you, needless to say, Philip's out of that number, will offer us an opportunity to converse, I'm good with that. I just don't want it to be the only thing that you walk away thinking that the only thing there is barbecue and Mexican food. Maybe that's the entree. And you know that all over the world, the way we first start to interact with people, chiefs of state invite you to a meal. And that's appropriate in every country. One of the things that's best is if you're asked to dine. When I went to Africa the first time, and it was very, very humble, and it was on mountains, and I thought I was going to die just getting up there. But the first and most important thing was to break bread with the folks that we spent time with. So why not in interacting with people of other cultures? One of the things that we do, even who we serve first, we think about that even in our own families. Is it the elder? Is it the so-and-so? Who takes the first bite? Who gets the first drink? Who gets the last piece of meat? There are a lot of things that happen around dining and culture that I think that we can do well with.
So we've reached the end of our hour. Here's your last question. Your inviting sense of humor is so influential in helping to awaken and encourage changes. How have you cultivated that, and how can we learn to better and more kindly use this important tool? So there's a softball question to end on.
I mean, I think, again, everybody has the tool that works best for them, whatever it is, and I just get a kick out of living. I can't help it. I just, you know... Like, I like to mess with Senator Mortimer because he's so pulled down and together. I just have to mess with him every time. And he reads this really country book. And the first time he was reading it, he said something about, what did he say? You were there. And it sounded like he said, he was talking about a black kid being ashy or something. I go, do you know what that means? You know, I had to stop him right in the middle, just some of that stuff. But I don't know. I mean, it's funny. It doesn't hurt me. It doesn't anything, just sometimes. But it's just some things that people don't know that they don't know. And sometimes if you can come with it with generosity and grace, that's the better opportunity. Because I stick my foot into it every once in a while, too. And I just think there's an opportunity if we can lighten up just a little bit. That's lighten up, not me lightening up for you, but...
Well, on that note, thank you very much, Sheree Buckner-Webb. And we do have the City Club mug and flowers that we will present Sheree after we're done. Thank you, everybody, and we are adjourned.
You have been listening to the City Club of Boise, a public forum discussing important issues of the day in a nonpartisan, civil manner. The next City Club forum is titled From Buell to Blue Man, and will feature Matt Ramsey, an Idahoan who has spent 16 years as a member of the Blue Man Group in New York. That forum will take place on Friday, the 17th of May. Find on-demand audio of this and other forums, learn about becoming a member, and see a schedule of coming events at cityclubofboise.org. Connect on Facebook and Twitter by searching for City Club of Boise.